Well, good evening. It's good to see you tonight. If you have your New Testaments, open them up to Luke, the 8th chapter. We want to look at our lesson tonight, solve our problems but save our pigs. I didn't invent this title. I am not smart enough or bold enough to come up with a title like that. I use a PowerPoint background service. A lot of guys that are preachers know about Graceway Media. And when I wanted to do a lesson on this particular event, then a lot of times I go in and type in, and they probably do the same thing. You type in the passage or some word that's you know, a key word, and boom, this popped up, you know. So I thought, well, okay, we'll just go with it because it does illustrate exactly what we want to talk about today. My dad, when he was a little boy, tells a story that the preacher they had in a gospel meeting said, "Now, you want to come back tonight?" And he was really billing it, said, "We're going to talk about the knot in the devil's tail." Well, my dad was just a little boy, man, and he just conjured up, you know, these cartoon pictures of the devil with a tail, and he said, "I could just think about that, you know." And I came back that night, and back in the days of blackboards, and so the guy goes up to the board, and my dad said, "I was thoroughly disappointed. The knot was N-O-T, and tail was T-A-L-E." And so the knot in the devil's tail was a whole lot different than what he was conjuring up in his mind. But Luke, the 8th chapter, beginning at verse 26, is a fascinating story of Jesus encountering a demonic man. We'll talk more about Matthew chapter 8, Mark chapter 5 also record this incident. And they record, both of them do, two men. And we'll talk about that in a second. But let's just read it so that we can put it before. So one other thing I need to say, my thanks to Rodney and Kathy Bain for coming all the way from College Station. Rodney's one of our elders now, so don't recruit. They're not coming back here. At least I hope they stay with us. He is a fine elder, and they're just a great addition to the congregation. Three of our elders out of five are retirees. They retired to us, and they were elders at congregations where they came from. And eventually after they were, and a lot of us knew them. It's like Rodney. We've known him. Because of their daughter living with us and being a part of us. In fact, her husband's one of our deacons. And so it's been quite a benefit to us. For a long time, College Station only had young people, and there were just no older people. When I moved there 12 years ago, I remember the elders put down the strengths and the columns and then their weaknesses, and in the column of strengths, the last item they put is, they were proud of this, we have an older population. And they put that in the column of strength, which most congregations, that's that you don't have the young people. And that was really a problem for us. But that has been solved in the last few years by people retiring to us. So it's been a benefit and a blessing. Didn't mean to get sidetracked, but just wanted to say hey to Rodney and to Kathy and for y'all to keep your cotton-picking hands off of them. All right, verse 26, Luke, the 8th chapter. Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. When Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house but among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles. But he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and drowned. And when the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. And so he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. As I mentioned to you, this is recorded in all three synoptic gospels, Matthew chapter 8, Mark chapter 5, or the other accounts. Matthew records that there were two demon-possessed men. Luke and Mark only indicate to us that there was one man. It's not a contradiction. It would be like you encounter two people, but one of them is much more dominant than the other one. Maybe one of them is the one that speaks and the other is silent. And so it would be more likely that you would concentrate on just saying there was a man who was demon-possessed. That doesn't necessarily make it a contradiction with the others. Matthew even indicates that it's the demons that speak. You get that even out of Luke's account when it says at verse 31, there is a legion inside of him. Folks, if that's a legion, as the Romans counted a legion, you understand that's several thousand individuals. That we don't even understand demon possession. We just, bam, come to the New Testament and here it is. And you see it there, and then as soon, of course, as the New Testament is pretty much over with, I mean, by the second century, you don't hear of these accounts, you don't see it. It's only in this time in which Jesus manifests himself on the planet. So Matthew indicates, Luke seems to indicate too, that they begged him, that they are the ones who are speaking at times. Sometimes it seems to indicate that the man is the one who is speaking. The demon-possessed man was a stark sight. Have you ever had somebody naked, completely naked, run up to you? I think that if that happens, I'm here. That's as far as I'm looking. I mean, that would be shock enough. It says he was exceedingly fierce, Matthew says, so that nobody could pass that way. What does that mean? Other than he came out threatening just as he runs up to Jesus and encounters him in this kind of manner, you can imagine. He was crying out day and night, Mark says, cutting himself with stones, and that he had lived among the tombs. And verse 29 in this text says that at times they would bind him with chains and shackles, but you have almost that Herculean strength that is manifested here. The demons apparently giving him that strength would break the bonds, and he would be driven by the demon into the desert. The other interesting feature is one that comes to me only as you study this passage and you read it. A lot of times what we do, and you do the same thing when we're reading a passage, we look for phrases or we look for words that occur over and over again, because a lot of times those are going to be key things to center on. Did you notice what word is? It happens here, a verb, and it happens several times. Look at verse 28 with me. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg," underline it, "I beg you, do not torment me." Now that is one Greek word. There are three different Greek words that are going to be translated by the English translators by our English word beg, or begging, or begged. Now, this same Greek word is found then at verse 38 when it says, "The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him, but Jesus sent him away." I tell you, in any way that you think about the word beg, I remember Dee used to do with me when I was in the training program. I don't know, Brent, if this happened with you, but he would always say there are denotations of words. You can define a word and say, here's what the American Heritage Dictionary says. But the more important idea is the connotation, he would say. All words have something they are implying, what we were talking about last night in the inference. They are inferring something. What if I say to you, "He asked for this," and then I say to you, "He begged for it"? Isn't there a stronger understanding of the word beg than just the idea of asking? In fact, if I said, "I asked my wife to marry me," but then I say, "I begged her," you would know the truth is on the latter. I begged her to marry me. Strong term, isn't it? Means the same thing in the sense that we know they're asking for something. Then the other word that is used, a different Greek word, is when the demons actually speak. Look at verse 31 and 32. "And they begged him," I'm reading the English Standard Version, "not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs were feeding on the hillside, and they begged him to to let them enter these. So a second different Greek word, now translated by our translators, by the same English word that we use as beg. The final incident is verse 37, even though it does not so translate it in the English Standard. It says, then all the people of the surrounding country, the Gerasenes, when they realized what he had done, asked, the word asked in English Standard, is interesting to me, because if you go to the parallel account in the English Standard Version, in Matthew chapter 8, verse 34, they translate it there in the same version, begged. So when you look at this incident, you have all three of the main players. You have the man that is demon-possessed, you have the demon, or the demons that are inside of him, and you have the people that come out to whom these pigs had belonged in that area of the country, and they all beg Jesus about something. And I'm going to tell you, that grasps hold of you when you're studying this passage, and you center your attention thinking about it. So let's begin our lesson then and think together about what it is that... So we're not moving on in the PowerPoint. So look with me again at verse 28. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me. And then verse 31, 32 that we just read. I want you to note first that if we understand what they are understanding about Jesus, which so many people in his day, and even in our day, do not grasp, is when they saw the man Jesus, that's all they saw. They just saw a man. But I'm going to tell you, any demon-possessed person knew immediately, every time you read the text, either that person was declaring as they do, what have we to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God. They know exactly who he is. There's no misgivings about them. They're not in doubt about it. There's no idea of any skepticisms or questions. They know that this man, Jesus, is in actuality Jesus, Son of the Most High God. In fact, Mark indicates to us in chapter 5, verse 6, that the man worshipped him. You even get that sense here, at least in the sense that they know he is much, much greater than him. The man falls down before. When he runs up to Jesus, he falls down before Jesus. Now, you could do that with a king, but in relationship to what we know they're saying, it is in the sense of honoring God who is greater than they are. I'm going to tell you, it matters that you know who is in charge, doesn't it? It matters that we know that God is almighty, that God is in charge. Several years ago, I read the story of a governor that was running for re-election, and he was known. I mean, his face would be known. Like if we knew Greg Abbott, we would understand. If we saw him out in public, that he was governor of our state. He had been campaigning all day, hadn't had time to eat. They had a barbecue chicken dinner at this particular place. And so he's coming down the line. He is famished, and they're putting one piece of chicken on every plate. So when he came to the lady, he asked her if he could have two pieces of chicken. And she said, no, you can only have one. And so he asked her politely again, and she refused, said, you can only have one. He said, lady, do you know who I am? I am governor of this state. And she said, do you know who I am? I am the lady in charge of the chicken. You get one piece. And so I've always thought of that. It didn't matter if he was governor. It mattered that she was in charge of that particular aspect. Well, folks, we need to know who has the authority, not only the power to enforce what needs to be enforced, but the right to rule. And these demons know that about him. They know, secondly, what Jesus is capable of doing. Look at verse 31. They begged him, this strong word in our language. They are pleading, they are imploring him to not command them. There's that authority that he has over them to depart into the abyss. Isn't that an amazing thing? What's the abyss? The word abyss is a word that we borrow directly from the Greek. It is the Greek word abusos, if I'm pronouncing that right, Jeff, help me out later. But the a part is a negative. The other part of the word, buthos, means the depth, or we would think of the sea. Or have you ever, you know, seen that bottomless thing sometimes? That, you know, remember one of the Indiana Jones, he throws the torch down, you know, and the light just finally fades. There's no bottom to it. Now think about that in relationship to the scariness of it, to something that's beyond the eye. And this particular word occurs here. It's used in Romans 10 and verse 7 and 9 times in the book of Revelation. If you look at the Romans account, here's what it says. You know this passage. When Jesus talks about Jesus Christ, he said nobody had to go up to heaven to bring him down to earth. Then he says, who will descend into the abuthos, into the abyss? That is, to bring Christ up from the dead. And already you understand there's a definition there. The place that is called the abyss is the realm of the dead. Beyond sight, beyond touch, beyond anything that we know in our physical world. And so is the definition. If you look it up in a Greek lexicon, it means the underworld, the abode, Archangel Gingrich says, of the dead and of the demons, that world that is beyond us, and particularly in relationship to this, where the disembodied spirits go. Notice that secondly, they attach to that place. They are fearful of it. Verse 28, listen to what he says. What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, again, that great imploring, do not what? Torment me. So this place that they fear so greatly to go to is a place of unbelievable torture, Strong says with the definition. Thayer, to vex with grievous pains or to torture. It's used in Matthew 8 when the centurion says, Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed, dreadfully tormented, the New King James says. Or suffering terribly, the English stands. Same word. Matthew, in his account of this demonic man, adds, have you come to torment us before the time? You think the devil does not know? Satan and his minions do not know that there is a day coming. See, they know exactly who Jesus is. They know what his power is. They know what his authority is. They're not operating under any kind of delusions that men operate under. That men think there is nothing beyond the grave. That they think nothing is on the other side. There's no life. There's no punishment. There's no God. There's no devil. The devil knows and his minions there is a time coming. There is a day coming where there will be irreversible judgment. So that Jesus says, for instance, in Matthew 25:41, then he will also say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For the devil and those who are his, where this place that we call hell is prepared for. If we want to share their fate, we will go to the same place. But it was prepared, Jesus said, for the devil and his angels. And they know exactly that that will happen. James records it this way. Chapter 2, verse 19, he says, you believe that there is one God? You do well. Even the demons believe, and listen to those last two words, and tremble. You ever tremble? You understand what he's saying? The Greeks use that same word to describe the hair on a cat back that stands up. Talk about the hair on the back of our neck standing up when we greatly fear something. The demons know exactly who Jesus is. They know what he's capable of doing. And they are in dread fear of him. So should we be if we are under his judgment. And that is that they know what he has the right to do. He has the right to cast them into this place. The Apostle Paul wrote to us in Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created, that are in heaven, that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones, dominions, or principalities, or powers, all things were created through him and for him. In Philippians 2:9-11, therefore God also has highly exalted him and given him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth. That all of these demons, and Satan included, know what he has the right to do. There are pigs that these people are raising. That always has risen, the thought being raised in people's mind, were these Jews? It is on that opposite side of Galilee, so that that would be the more Gentile country, but are they Jews that have given themselves over to raising an animal that is unclean and are guilty because of that? There's no way of knowing exactly. And really, you don't need to know that for the point of the story. The pigs, Mark tells us, are 2,000 in number. Mark 5 and verse 13. I have never seen a herd of 2,000 pigs. I guess you'd have to go to a slaughter place, a place where they feed out pigs like cattle, and you might see 2,000 of them. But can you imagine seeing such a herd? But who did they belong to? They belonged, we would say, to the Gerasene or the Gadarene people, however your version translates it. You ever thought, why did they have 2,000 pigs? That's how you're going to feed people. Years ago, I was in a meeting in Nashville, and in the afternoon, I went to the Hermitage. I love history, so I wanted to go see where Andrew Jackson's home was. And when you make the tour, and I had one of those things where you plug in your ear, and you've got it, you know, and you're just walking around on your own, listening to it from thing to thing, you finally get around to the backyard, and there's this big brick house, as I recall, brick structure, that's with inside the picket fence. And so you're thinking, what is this building? It's not very pretty. It's inside the yard, as we would say. That was the place where all the hams hung. The smokehouse, basically. That's not actually where they smoked it, but that's where they were storing it for the winter. And the only two people, as you're listening to the tape, tells you, the only two people that had keys to that place were Andrew Jackson and the steward of the plantation. Because that place was going to feed the plantation and all the people on it throughout the winter months when there would be no food to gather in the fields. Can you imagine why these people are upset? All 2,000 of their pigs, once the demons enter them, it drives those animals mad, berserk. They just run to the edge of this cliff. In fact, Brent Moody and Reuben were telling me that in their trip over there, they think they know where exactly that thing is. And it is a steep place where you just tumble off and then they would drown into the Sea of Galilee below. If these folks are depending on that for their livelihood, what's the first reaction you have to this? Would it not be what the Gerasenes are? By what right did Jesus allow this to happen? It's the fact that Jesus didn't do it directly, but Jesus allowed the demons to enter into these pigs. I'm going to tell you, we're going to miss something very, very important, I think, if we don't remember who the pigs really belong to. Remember David when he assembled all that stuff that Solomon could then have to build the temple? He says, but who am I? And who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? For all things come from you, and of your own, we have given to you. Ever thought about the fact that that's not your IRA? That's not your pension? Those children that sit in your lap do not belong to you. And I, in some ways, if we understand it correctly, do not belong to me. We are His. He owns all of it. When Psalms writes in chapter 50, verse 10 and 11, the psalmist, he says, for every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. I know all the birds of the mountains, and the wild beasts of the field are mine. We talk about ownership. That's your piece of property that you own. That's your house. Those pigs belong to the master who allowed the demons to enter into them. They didn't belong to the gathering people. And then I think of the story of Job. It says of all the suffering that he went through. In fact, you know this in the beginning. It says, his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. And he said to her, you speak as a foolish woman speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And then whoever is the whoever is the divine, or rather the inspired, pardon me, the inspired writer of this says, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So Job spoke the truth. And he says, we can accept good from God's hand, but sometimes we're going to accept adversity. And then it ties into the end of the book when, after Job has gone through everything and God has revealed himself to him but never explains what has happened, just bedazzles him with, how can you understand this when you can't even understand how I created the things of this world? All those who had been his acquaintances came to him and they consoled him and comforted him. Notice again it says, for all the adversity that the Lord had brought. And the inspired author has already told us in the beginning that he did not sin when he spoke those same words. And when you think about it, folks, it's a terrifying thing to think about. That God may dispose of me and mine however he sees fit. And I am to bow my head to him and worship him, no matter if it is the most horrible thing that happens. Turn back one chapter in Luke 7 and notice another incident where this happens. In John the Baptist, at verse 18 of chapter 7, it says, the disciples of John, he is in prison. Remember, because he had dared to say, you have no right to your brother Philip's wife. The disciples of John reported all these things to him, and John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to the Lord, saying, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? When you think about what John's purpose was, and even what he may have had in mind that the kingdom of heaven was to be like, and here he is sitting in this. Can you imagine our prisons are like going to a Motel 6, or maybe a Hilton, I guess we should say, in comparison with what they would have been like in that day. And when you think about what he is asking, he is wanting to know, are you the one? This ought not to be so. And when the men had come to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? In that hour he healed many people of diseases and plagues and evil spirits, and on many who were blind he bestowed sight. And he answered them, go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the good news preached to them. Isaiah's prophecy about Jesus, the Messiah, he is who he claimed to be. But in these words, almost you think he lowered his voice and said, you make certain that he hears this. And blessed is the one who is not offended because of me. In effect, he was saying to John, John, you're going to die in that squalor of a rat hole. You're going to hear the last things that come down that hallway or the boots of the soldiers that will come to behead you. And it is for my glory and my purposes that will come to pass. And you will be blessed if you are not offended, because that's how you will end. Folks, we don't like stories like that. We want to think that everything is going to go well and everything will be blessed and that we will always have everything turn out the right way in our lives. And that simply may not happen in our case. And if it doesn't, will we be offended at him and turn our backs upon him and say, if this is who you are, I want nothing to do with you? Or will we know that he has every right to dispense with us as he sees fit? And if that's what is to happen to me, then let me praise God and worship him, whether it is good that comes from him or adversity. The second group of people that bring this begging to Jesus are the Gadarenes. When they come out and they hear the story of what's happened, they see the fact that all their pigs have been destroyed. The Matthew account says they begged him to leave their presence. And in verse 37, in this passage, they asked him to depart. They wanted nothing to do with him. And isn't that a fascinating thing? Do men and women today beg Jesus to leave in the same way? Do men and women encounter Jesus and they want nothing to do with him because he offends them? He's done something that's just so totally against what they think is the way things ought to be. They want nothing to do with him. We deal with it, don't we, when we come to the subject in our culture of homosexuality. When you read what he states to us in passages like 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 10, do not be deceived, neither fornicators nor adulterers, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor sodomites will inherit the kingdom of God. I want to be very careful here. I want you to understand that I understand. There was a congregation that I preached at one time that after a while they felt close enough to come and say to me what it was they struggled with. There were five men in that congregation that struggled with homosexuality. They had found one another through a common guy that was a trained counselor, and he was helping them to see their way through it. They were Christians. They knew it was wrong. Two of them were married. Two of them had children. But they still struggled with that. Folks, we need to be compassionate with all manner of sin. I can't change what the text says. You can't practice homosexuality and please the God of heaven. That's just the fact of the matter. It is sin before him. Now, you may continue to have the desire for something that is wrong, just like an alcoholic has the desire for alcohol, or a drug addict for drugs, or a sexual addict for the illicit factor of that. It doesn't mean that you have to go and serve it and do them. That's what these guys understood. That's what they fought. That's what they believed. And that's what they overcame. But we need to be a people that instead of being turned away from somebody that would admit this, we need to be compassionate and understanding. Was not the Apostle Paul? He worked with these Corinthians. He said in another place, and such were what? Some of you. But we must not change the gospel's message one whit, or we will be accursed. I cannot preach somebody who practices homosexuality into heaven because God said it is sin. And we must not change that message. I preached like this one time when I was home. Unbeknownst to me, there was a lady in the congregation, a member there, who both her son and her daughter were in that lifestyle. And she simply told other people, she said, I'll not come back and hear him anymore. Well, it wasn't that she was offending me. She can read the Word of God, and what I was preaching was only the Word of God in regard to that. And I tried to do it as a kind of way as I have tried to do right now in saying we need to be compassionate and all that, but we can't change what the text says. But some people don't want that. And they will beg Jesus to go away from them. You ever deal with remarriage, divorce and remarriage? Matthew 19 and verse 9, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. You ever notice how many times people can come up with all kinds of reasons for why in their particular circumstances they have, if it's questionable, a right to remarry? You ever thought about the response of the disciples to what we just read out of Matthew 19? Have you ever thought about that? They looked at Jesus and said, if it's that way, then it would just be better if you don't get married. And Jesus' response to them was simply that some men are made eunuchs. And you know what a eunuch is. Some men are born eunuchs. Some men are made eunuchs by other men. And then he said, and some men make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. You can live a celibate life. Jesus did. Paul did. Barnabas did. You can live a full life in the eyes of God and be right. But the one thing you cannot do is live a life and you are in adultery and be right. And in the day of judgment, we will stand, all of us, bare and naked as it were, God seeing through every kind of argument that we've put up, any kind of thing that we've done in our mind to justify what we are doing. He will pierce right through it and get to the heart of it and say, depart from me or enter in, based on how we responded to His will. But there are some people who cannot believe that their son or daughter would have to live celibate the rest of their days to be right with God, even though Jesus said some people make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake in response to this passage. And some families will say, no, that cannot be. And they get mad, and there's an internal fight, and everything happens in congregations that are over that. And I think of the whole time God is looking down at this and witnessing it. Floyd Thompson was a great old gospel preacher from California. He used to come to Texas in gospel meetings when I was a young man. Maybe some of you heard him. But I remember Floyd talking about this passage with my brother Thompson, talking about this passage one time. And he said that a guy wrote him a 10-page answer to why he thought the guilty party, for instance, to take up that mantle, could remarry. And Brother Thompson said, a friend of mine told me about him doing this, said he wrote him back a postcard to a 10-page response. And he said, please read Matthew 19, 1 through 9, and Matthew 5, 32. Do you know what he's saying to him? When the disciples got through hearing this passage, they didn't go, as my friend Harold Turner says, huh? They didn't go, wait a minute, what? They got it. And they said, if that's the way it is, it'd be better if a man not marry at all. And then Jesus' response is about the eunuch. For some people who will not have Jesus because of what he says about this topic. For some people that will not have Jesus. You know, I'm having trouble again. Sorry, let my notes lapse. Because of baptism. We looked at that last night, and I'm not going to belabor that. Sometimes it is because of withdrawal, that somebody has to withdraw. And again, you have that family situation that comes into a matter where they love son or daughter more than they love God. Or they love their husband and wife more than they love God. And God has to say to us, as he does in Matthew 10, 37, he that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Or he that loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. There can come nothing between us and our God, including our family, and most of all our family. And so there are a lot of things you could list under this that we could do exactly what the Gadarenes did. The final person in this story is the man who, when you come to verse 38 and he's in his right mind and he's been healed, he wants to go with Jesus. And he says, the man whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him, but Jesus sent him away. The Holman Christian Standard Bible translates it, kept begging him, because it isn't in perfect tense. It was in, he just kept on. He wanted to go with Jesus, but Jesus said, no, you go back and proclaim. Sometimes he would tell him not to. You remember in some incidents, but here he tells the man to go and proclaim. And Jesus commanded the very opposite of what the man wanted. But here's what faith is. The essence of faith is you just trust and obey. You do what, as we talked about last night, God said to do. So, we close the lesson. Of the three characters, who do you resemble the most? And you know immediately, you know what we're all thinking. Well, we'd be like that guy that was healed. Go back to Andrew Jackson and the story that I was telling you. I read a biography about him when he was a judge in Nashville, when it was just still a real frontier, rough town. There was a huge guy that had been convicted, or rather charged with some kind of crime, and he had pistols in his hands, and he wouldn't be arrested. And the sheriff left the courtroom, and a big hubbub, noise, ado was happening in the streets. And a minute, the guy came back, and he said he couldn't. The sheriff said, we can't take you. And so Andrew Jackson, if you know anything about him, was not going to take no for an answer. And so he said, then deputize me. And so the sheriff did. He deputized Andrew Jackson, who's the judge. And Andrew Jackson grabbed two pistols. And it says he marched up to that guy with them both cocked. And he said to him, submit or I will blow you through. And it said that big old guy that had scared the sheriff and his posse away just dropped the pistols he was holding and just submitted. A couple of days later, after they cuffed him and took him in, put him in the jail, they asked him, why'd you do that? And all these other men couldn't arrest you. He said, there weren't shoot in nary anyone else's eyes, but there was shoot in Jackson's eyes. And what God is wanting in all of us is that we understand who he is. And how we should respond to him is in humble obedience, quickly to all that he commands us, and then know our place in the scheme of things. He wants people who have shoot in their eye, if we were to put it in that story. You're subject to heaven's invitation. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you tonight to obey the gospel or to come back to him if you need to confess sins while we stand and sing.